Well, there's one thing for certain. I can't possibly come up to that standard, so you can relax before dinner. But and these are just a few observations, having watched this scene over many decades, in particular the tragedy since 2007. But in framing a suitable jurisdiction for an efficient, safe, and economical banking and financial system, we don't start with a clean sheet of paper. There are political imperatives which stand in the way of that, but even if that weren't the case, the resulting growth in the size and complexity and internationalization of the major banks gives rise to problems which is very, very difficult for nation states to solve on their own. There is a great deal of international cooperation, but in spite of that, it is not easy to decide as a nation where the responsibility lies, because that's where the taxpayers' money in the event of disaster has to come from. It is not an easy task for the nation state. The first political imperative is that the system must be kept from total collapse. It must be kept safe from total collapse because of the damage that does to the economy as a whole if it occurs. And you've just seen that from Andy's slides. Another, which is a much more recent consideration, but very, very awkward, is that retail depositors have to be kept safe from loss because they've all got votes. And I'm going to come back in a few minutes to why that is so awkward. A basic truth about banking, which has to be borne in mind, is that it is inherently a risky business. A banker accepts deposits, and it's his or her business to lend it out to borrowers. The margin pays for overheads, services the capital invested in the bank, and yields the profit. And lending money, obviously, runs the risk that some loans will go bad. There's no such thing as totally safe lending, except in an organization like the Trustee Savings Bank, with all the money lent to the government. And so the whole thing is bound to carry substantial risks. Even a prudent banker is bound to make some loans which go bad, but if prudent rules and the banker's judgment is good, the profit should be covered out of the, sorry, the, loan, the losses should be covered out of the profit. And if the judgment is not quite as prudent as that and the losses exceed the profit, then it's got to be made good out of capital. And if the capital runs out, then bankruptcy follows. And depositors are at risk of not getting their money back. And they thus have to have enough capital to ensure confidence that customers will get their money back. But over and above this ordinary commercial requirement, which has been present since long, long, long ago, classical times, banks are in such a position and deal with each other to such an extent that the government has to bear in mind that the collapse of the system may occur. This encourages banks to impose capital requirements to, and indeed liquidity requirements, to try and ensure that big interconnected banks won't bring the whole system down. The need for capital is all very straightforward, but holding capital is very expensive, and that capital has to be serviced. So if you require, this is very controversial stuff, I'm afraid I'm coming on to, if you require banks to hold more capital than they otherwise would judge to be enough, they will be tempted to cut lending, to keep the ratio right, rather than raising more capital. But even if they don't do that, and in any event, they have to find ways of making more profit from their assets to cover the extra cost of servicing the extra capital. In other words, you have to take more risk to make more profit because of the regulation for the extra capital you're made to hold. And the heavy capital requirements inevitably increase the risk within the system, and that's something which I think is not sufficiently recognized. Those managing banks in the Western world are, in fact, being nudged right now towards extra risk. And they know, each bank knows that the others are doing it, and there is a collective migration away from the basic standards of banking prudence. It's an awkward situation. Banks have to deal with each other. Obviously, some banks are going to end up with surplus funds at the end of each day, and some with not enough, and those have to be matched. But that's a sort of elementary example of why banks have to deal with each other. In fact, the scale, the present scale of banks dealing with each other is absolutely enormous, and it is thus inevitable in today's world, and this is one of the facts we have to accept, it's unavoidable that if one large bank fails, it may easily jeopardize the health of the others. So the system has got to be kept secure, and governments have got to be ready to step in and ensure that the liabilities of a failed bank get discharged so that the other creditors don't themselves collapse. The need for governments to step in with taxpayers' money in order to prevent collapse has always been there and always will be there. And if you go, for example, to Venice, just across the Rialto Bridge towards the market, you'll find the Banco del Giro, the site of it, some of the building of it, which was founded in 1619 by the government of Venice when the whole Venetian banking system collapsed, and that bank existed until the middle of the 19th century. So that risk has always been there, and it always will be. And when you put on top of that the enormous size of banks, which has come about since the globalization of trade and the freedom of capital flows, you can see that the resulting system task of keeping the banking system safe is very, certainly not easy. In fact, I think it's very, very difficult. And this leads on to, I think, what I see as the central difficulty. Governments have to step in, and as I said, it's government, it's taxpayers' money that they use, and they are inevitably tempted to increase capital requirements to try and make banks safer and reduce the risk. But as I've already pointed out, that actually increases the propensity to risk and the need to service the capital. And bank managements all know that the other banks are doing the same, and it becomes riskier, as I've said. Prudent management of banks is thus rather suppressed. And when prudent commercial judgment has to give way to regulation, standards drop, everyone behaves to the limit of regulation, because they all know their competitors are doing this, and you have more rather than less problem. The other thing is that regulation, however well-intentioned, is very often defective. And the pre-2007 Basel capital requirements were so framed that they actually led, in my opinion, and the opinion of many other people's, led absolutely directly to the enormous losses caused in the securitized debt market, which was one of the major causes of the whole trouble in 2007. You can see the full story of that in Gillian Tett's book called Fool's Gold. It's an example of bad regulation having utterly tragic consequences, and history tells you, unfortunately, that regulation is never perfect. It always has defects. And right now, we're in a big debate about how regulation should be handled. But rather than taking up your time tonight, I suggest in that connection you read remarks by people like Douglas Flint and his chief executive at HSBC, who know this subject at least as well as any regulator. People think that moral hazard affects bank managements because of the prospect of enormous bonuses. And maybe there is a bit of truth in that. If there is a prospect that you'll get a huge bonus, didn't exist in my day, unfortunately, but if there's a prospect of a huge bonus, if you earn your employer a big profit, that's very alluring. So I suppose bonuses do have some effect, which is, I'm certainly think that they're unacceptable in the eyes of the public, these gigantic bonuses. But there's a much, much more important factor at work, and I do hope this is fully taken into account by those in authority, and that's that banks are no longer owned by bankers. They're owned by shareholders who are mostly, that's to say in the case of the UK, much more than two-thirds, owned by agents for beneficial owners, that's to say fund managers, managing other people's money. And they are often, if not usually, just as much interested in making capital gains as in the long-term health of the businesses in which they invest. And that greatly encourages the attraction of short-term gains, which is most assuredly unhealthy, because it encourages those managing banks on behalf of those owners to gear themselves up to run a riskier, higher margin lending portfolio than a prudent bank would do. But if it's what the shareholders want, that's actually how managements are pretty well bound to respond. You can thus see in the view of somebody like me a picture emerging of a problem with no satisfactory answer. The answer is certainly not to be found in a reversion to Glass-Steagall, which some people advocate, that is splitting commercial and retail banking from securities business. Because ordinary customers want their banks, ordinary commercial customers want their banks to be able to provide services which can really only come efficiently from investment banking operations, like covering long-term forex risks or interest rate risks, or substituting bond finance at a fixed rate of interest for bank lending. And in any event, the evil which Glass-Steagall was introduced to counter no longer exists in the way that it did in the 1920s, because nowadays, with modern information technology, securities can easily be widely distributed with full transparency and information, and they're often rated by independent rating agencies. And in any event, the banking tragedies that we've seen here, like Northern Rock, Bradford and Bingley, and HBOS, which caused the trouble at Lloyd's, were not universal banks. So the recommendations of the Vickers report, I think, should be looked at with that in mind. The result of all this trouble is, and we're currently seeing this, heavier and more intrusive regulation, which leaves less and less room for prudent management in the true sense. And if the past standard of regulation is anything to go by, it won't provide the answer that we all want. Trouble is that if you impose very expensive regulation, which involves cost, great deal, the cost of all the capital, and incidentally the extra liquidity which is required, plus a huge wage cost of the internal regulatory work which banks now have to undertake, as well as the direct cost of regulation which has to be borne by the sector, if you do that, you will drive managers to seek higher returns from riskier business and find ways of overcoming the barriers imposed by regulation. And here I'd like to just emphasize what I think is a real emerging worry. Right now, because of the cost of bank intermediation, and you saw Andy's slide on that, because of that cost, the big so-called clubs have arisen in the United States, directly connecting lenders with borrowers without bank intermediation. And that's all right so far as it goes, but it is a great deal more risky than the business conducted through the intermediation of a well-capitalized bank. But much worse than that, this is now being developed on the a retail level. And right now, even in this country, or certainly in this country, you can find websites which connect lenders and borrowers without the lender being able to rely on the judgment of somebody who understands lending risk and underwrites that judgment with his own capital. And the end of that process will, I think, almost assuredly involve scandals and losses. So, and I'm nearly coming to the end, so don't give up hope of your dinner. What I say is this. Stop imagining that you can make banks completely safe and accept that the best route to safety is through prudent management. And if you start with that proposition, you then have to look for ways of encouraging and incentivizing prudence. We've already seen that bank owners won't provide that. They want short-term profit, and they're not at all in favor of particularly prudent management. So the only way you can encourage prudent management, I think, I'd be delighted to be proved wrong about this, is to make depositors and other bank creditors take some risk so that they will choose to deal only with prudently run banks and not risky ones. And if that happens, then the cost of bank deposits and other liabilities which the banks undertake will go down below the costs incurred by less prudently run managements, and the incentive to run a bank prudently will be rewarded by increased profit. And I think myself that unless that or something like that is accepted and begins to happen, I think the chances of making a banking system economical, efficient, and safe are no higher today than they have ever been. And unfortunately, I see little chance of political leaders having what I think would be wisdom and long-term vision enough to see that that's necessary. Instead, I fear that they will embrace an ever heavier and more cumbersome and complicated and inefficient system, which will do, in the end, nobody any good, certainly not those people who need bank finance. So that's you've earned your dinner.